humans are really good at kind of bouncing back after a stressful event, whether it's a stressful event in the world or whether it's in their own life. People can get stressed, but then really quickly bounce back to the same state that they were before.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another episode of Famous Failures, where I interview the world's most interesting people about their failures and what they learn from them. I'm your host, Ozan Morol. Today's guest on the show is Tali Sherratt. Tali is a professor of cognitive neuroscience and a leading expert on the neural basis of emotion, decision-making, and optimism. Her work has been featured in numerous media outlets, including the New York Times, Time Magazine, The Washington Post, CNN, BBC, and much, much more. Her TED Talk on the optimism bias was viewed over 2 million times. Her latest book is called The Influential Mind, What the Brain Reveals About Our Power to Change Others. The book tackles the neuroscience behind influence, what we so often get wrong about it, how we can learn to influence other people, and how to understand when we are being influenced ourselves. In the interview, Tali and I discuss how our brains are wired to look on the bright side and why that tendency can both help and hurt us depending on circumstances. Why stress can diminish our natural tendency toward optimism, how we can remain optimistic in the face of failure or fear of failure, why a failure in Tali's own life ended up giving her the idea for her research on the optimism bias. We talk about why facts and data don't tend to change minds once we actually make up our mind about something. We discuss when hope can be a better influencer than fear and the other way around. And finally, we talk about how Tali would advise the Democratic Party leading up to the 2020 presidential elections. Before I play the interview, if you'd like to keep in touch with me, your host, you can sign up for my weekly newsletter, which goes out to nearly 14,000 people. It's called The Weekly Contrarian. It lands in your inbox every Thursday and shares a new article that I wrote that week, along with other recommendations for books that I loved, other articles that I read. Really anything that helps challenge conventional wisdom and help you look at the world a little differently. You can sign up for that by going over to weeklycontrarian.com. And if you sign up, you'll also get my ebook, The Contrarian Handbook, 8 Principles for Innovating Your Thinking. Without further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Tali Sherratt. And thank you, as always, for listening. Tali, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So I just wanted to begin initially with your background. You're a professor of cognitive neuroscience. You initially started out by studying negative emotions, but then later pivoted to studying optimism. What prompted the change?
I started my PhD in the year 2000, and I was interested in actually in memories, and specifically in traumatic memories. So how do we remember negative events from our past? And 9/11 happened soon after I started my PhD. I was doing it in New York at NYU. And so one of the things that we were interested in is what causes what's known as flashbulb memories, which is these kind of seemingly vivid, detailed memories of past events, usually traumatic. And we brought in people who were on the island in 9/11 and recorded their brain activity to kind of try to figure out the mechanisms, and saw that these vivid memories were the result of an interaction of two areas, the amygdala, which is really important for emotion, and the hippocampus, which is important for memory. And so when something really emotional happens, these two regions talk to each other and they create really vivid memories. And so I finished my PhD and I went to Harvard to do a short postdoc. And when I got there, I learned that people there were really interested in this idea that the system that we have in our brain for memories may have not evolved for memories at all, but rather to be able to imagine the future so we can plan ahead. And really, in order to imagine the future, so for example, imagine what you're going to be doing tomorrow or imagine your next summer vacation. What you're doing is you're taking bits and pieces of information from your past and putting them together to create something new. And I thought that was a really interesting idea. And maybe I could test whether what we've learned about how you remember these traumatic events, like events of 9/11, whether it's the same mechanism when you're imagining really negative traumatic events in the future. And so I started my first experiment, and I asked people to imagine these negative events in the future. But to my surprise, people turned these negative events into positive events. So for example, I would say, imagine the breakup of a romantic relationship. And they said, I broke up with my girlfriend and then I found a better one. Or I would say, you know, imagine getting stuck out of your apartment and there's, you know, you don't have the keys. And they imagined calling the landlady and she would come in with the keys and let them in. I was kind of surprised by this. I wasn't quite sure what was going on. And I was a little bit upset because, you know, subjects were ruining my experiment. And so for about 2 months, I tried to get them to imagine negative events. And, you know, they would to some extent, but very often they would turn them into these kind of fun events in the future. And so then I was looking at the literature to try to explain what was going on. And I found the literature on what is known as the optimism bias, which is people's tendency to imagine the future as being better than the past or the present, and their tendency to overestimate the positive events that will happen to them in the future and underestimate the negative events. And so at that point, I thought, well, okay, if this is what they're doing, you know, we'll go with it. And so that was the first study on the optimism bias, which was how people imagine mostly positive events in the future. And I found that super interesting, and it was relevant to so many different things, you know, to our personal lives, to our professional lives, and really that kind of engaged me for quite a while.
Absolutely. So that's really interesting. And I have two questions related to your response. The first is, do you think there's an evolutionary underpinning to the optimism bias? And the reason I ask that is, you know, I can see why there might be an evolutionary reason for our ability to notice negative feedback, right? So like the, you know, the rattling in the bushes could be a prey. And so our ability to notice and exaggerate that negative input can have an evolutionary benefit, because that means, well, if we assume that that's actually a predator, then that means you don't end up as lunch for a saber-toothed tiger. So where does the optimism bias come in from an evolutionary perspective, if at all?
Well, first of all, the optimism bias is most predominantly about the future, not about the past or the present. So it's not about detecting stimuli in your environment, although it could be, but it's most of the research, and definitely the research that I do, is about what do you predict is going to happen in the future? How do you imagine the future? And in fact, when you look at memories, what you see is that people remember positive and negative events equally well. What matters is how arousing the events are, not their valence, not whether they're positive or negative. So when it comes to memory, you remember really important events in your past, you know, the really bad events as well as the really good events, and you learn from them in order to decide on better action in the future to get better rewards. And so the question is then, why do people have an optimism bias about the future? So on the one hand, there seems to be benefits, right? So the traditional view to this, and again, you know, the optimism bias has been known since the first study was in 1980. But what was not known was how it comes about, what actually causes it. And that's what we were studying. But because it was known since the 1980, a lot of people have thought about this. And the traditional view has been that there are advantages to the optimism bias and there's disadvantages, and the advantages probably outweigh the disadvantages. And the advantages are that if you imagine positive events in the future and you think, you know, things are going to go well, well, first of all, that enhances motivation. So if you think, my company is going to succeed, you put more effort into it. Why? If you think, well, this is not going to work out, you're not putting effort into it. And it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy because your predictions change your actions and your actions change reality or the outcomes, right? The second thing is that it turns out the optimists, all else being equal, are healthier and they live longer. And the reason is, again, if you have these relatively positive expectations, that really reduces your anxiety, reduces your physiological stress, and that's good for your health. And finally, it enhances exploration. So in order to kind of explore different things, you have to think that there's better things out there than what you are currently doing or seeing. So, you know, if you think back to our ancestors deciding to leave Africa to explore the rest of the world, they had to imagine that there's something out there and it's better than what they have. So they had to have some kind of optimism about what they would find. So these are all the good things. And indeed, there's a lot of studies showing correlation between optimism and success in business, in politics, in sports, in academia. However, the negative side of it is that you may underestimate your risk, right? So if you're underestimating your risk, you might not do the precautionary actions that you need to do, not, you know, buy insurance when you actually need to, not wear a helmet when you ride your bike, not go to medical screenings, and that's not a good thing. So it was thought, well, okay, there's negative, the positive. Probably the positive has outweighed on the negative, and although there's negative consequences, overall, it's a good thing. However, then later on, people came and said, well, listen, maybe the advantages outweigh the disadvantages, but only in certain environments. So in relatively safe environments, like the one that you and I are in today, well, maybe the advantages of good effects on motivation, exploration, health, and so on, really outweigh the negatives. But really in dangerous environments, rife with threat, underestimating risk can be pretty bad, right? And in those environments, it's actually not adaptive at all. So it depends on your environment. We, you know, knew about all these theories, and our thoughts were, well, it would really be the most adaptive if your optimism bias comes and goes in different environments. In other words, we have an optimism bias in these kind of relatively safe environments, in our regular environments, but put people under threat, put them under stress, and the optimism bias will go away very quickly, and then it can come back. And we found that that's exactly what happens. Which is, if you stress people out, for example, we did a study where we brought undergrads into our lab. We wanted to stress them out. So we told them that they had to give a talk about a surprise topic that we will give them, and we will rate them and, you know, judge them. We will videotape them and put it on YouTube.
That will do it.
And our students were quite stressed. And then we gave them all these tasks that we've given, you know, many, many, many times before, published many, many studies about, always seeing these optimism biases, which I can tell you exactly what we see. But when they were stressed, it went away. We couldn't see the optimism bias. Same thing with firefighters. We did a study on firefighters in the state of Colorado. So firefighters have very different days. Some days are quite relaxed. They're kind of chilling out in the station, and other days are rife with life-threatening events. And again, we find that when the firefighters are stressed, the optimism bias goes away. When the firefighters are relaxed, the optimism bias is there. So I think what's adaptive about the optimism bias is that it flexibly changes according to your environment. When it is adaptive, when the advantages outweigh the disadvantages, it's there. But when you're in a really threatening environment, it's not as adaptive, it actually goes away and it adapts.
If the environment has such a huge impact on the optimism bias, so if you're stressed, it goes away. If you're in a relaxed state, it comes back. How does, say, you know, the what we see in the news, all the negativity in politics, social media, so on and so forth, really all of these negative feedback loops that we're receiving from contemporary society, how do you think that affects our own outlook and our ability to remain optimistic?
So I think to answer this, I really need to tell you on our central finding, really the big contribution that we made to understanding the optimism bias is understanding how it is generated. And what we found is that these positive expectations, biased expectations of the future emerges because you learn better about unexpected positive information than unexpected negative. So for example, we do studies when we ask you, you know, what is the likelihood that you will suffer from cancer, or get divorced or Alzheimer's or be robbed or be a victim of card fraud? And what we find is that when we give people tell us what they think their likelihood is. They might say, my likelihood of being, you know, getting cancer is 40%. And when we tell them, hey, listen, there's good news, actually the likelihood for you is only 30%, they update their beliefs really fast. But when we tell them, hey, it's bad news, let's say someone thought the likelihood of cancer is 10%, and we say, hey, for you, it's actually more like 30%, they don't update their beliefs as much. So in other words, if you go around the world updating your beliefs a little bit more from unexpected positive information about the future than unexpected negative, then you will have this bias about, you know, what will happen to you in the future. This is kind of the what we think is one of the major mechanisms that is generating the optimism bias. And again, what we found is that you put people under stress, this goes away because they become hypervigilant to negative information. They start learning quite well from negative information. They update their beliefs. And that's why the optimism bias goes away, because now they're learning from positive and negative to the same extent. And so when you have stressful events happening around the world, whether it is financial market collapse, terrorist attack, natural disaster, people get stressed. Even if the terrorist attack is halfway around the world, people get quite stressed, and that creates this stress physiological reaction. And so they start learning from the negative, in which case at that time, there's a lot, right? Because there's going to be a lot of negativity in the news about, you know, these terrorist attacks or whatever it is that's going on. People are going to take that information in, change their beliefs, and actually can become overly pessimistic. Indeed, the information that we have from the media, if it has an effect on us, if it stresses us out, can change the way that our brain works, making us more hypervigilant and sensitive to taking in the negative over the positive.
So, for example, if there is a terrorist attack on an airplane, people stop flying airplanes.
Yeah. So this can cause suboptimal decisions. So, for example, as you say, if there's a terrorist attack, people then may decide to not fly and then go in a car when we know that, you know, driving is actually more dangerous than flying. Or after a financial collapse, a lot of people decide to sell their stocks instead of hold on, where, again, this is the suboptimal action to take.
And is there anything we can do to then remain optimistic, even in response to these stressful events that trigger learning in us? And I'd love to explore this question, if that's okay with you, in the context of failure or fear of failure, since that's what the topic of the podcast is about. Failure is a stressful event, fear of failure similarly. When we do face setbacks in our own lives, is there anything we can do to remain optimistic? Anything that the research shows?
One thing that's really important here is individual differences to how we react to stressful events or failures. So most individuals are actually quite resilient. Humans are really good at kind of bouncing back after a stressful event, whether it's a stressful event in the world, like a terrorist attack, or whether it's in their own life. People can get stressed, but then really quickly bounce back to the same state that they were before. So these events actually, on average, don't have a long-lasting effect. Now, as I said, there's individual differences. So there are people who are super resilient. So even in the face of big trauma, they would still remain quite resilient. And then, of course, there are people who are a little bit more susceptible to stressful events, and they may have a continuous long impact, even if the event has gone away. And also it matters, you know, how long the event is, how many of these negative events are we encountering in our life. For most of us, it's not, in fact, the situation that we are in a high stressful event for most of the time. By the way, age is quite important here. So it turns out that the peak of our stress is in midlife. Mm. So stress is quite low in teenagers and kids. It goes up, 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 reaches peak in your midlife, and then goes down. Happiness goes the other way. So happiness is quite high in kids and teenagers. It goes down, 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 reaches rock bottom in your midlife, and then goes up again, actually, as we become older. And indeed, we find that in midlife is the least amount of optimism bias. And it's the time that people actually learn from negative and positive almost equally. While when you're, you know, younger, or when you're quite older, you learn better from positive. So there's a lot of these individual differences that matter quite a bit.
Yeah, and that makes sense that there are individual differences in terms of resiliency. But let's suppose that for one reason or the other, you're not particularly resilient in the face of a failure. Is there anything you can do? And this can be strategies based on research or strategies that you've used in your own life that you can use to turn on the optimism bias, so to speak, and to build up resiliency.
So because stress is really important here for the optimism bias, when stress is high, optimism bias is low. When stress is low, optimism bias is high. So one of the most important thing to do is simply to try to reduce stress. And there's a lot of work on how to reduce stress, right? And so it's really things that we all know about, which is exercise. Exercise reduces stress, social connections and interactions. So if you have more social support, that reduces stress as well. There are other ways which are more like cognitively effortful, which is rethinking the situation. And that works too for some individuals. If it's not exercise, some people find meditation to reduce stress. So anything that reduces stress is going to put you back into kind of more balanced state. And that will then trigger the optimism bias to come back.
That makes sense. And I'm sure there are individual differences as to which of these strategies works well. You know, so meditation might work for one person, but not necessarily the other. And so there's bound to be individual differences there as well. I'd like to transition to your recent book, and most recent book, I should say, The Influential Mind, in just a moment here. But before I do that, I'd love to ask you about a valuable failure in your own life. So if you look back on your career, on your life, what stands out as a valuable failure, and what makes it valuable?
One of the most difficult experiences and years of my life was the one that then triggered all the success that came after it. I finished my PhD. I went to Harvard to do a postdoc, and I got to Harvard and I had some ideas of what I wanted to study. And it was mostly kind of continuing what I did with my PhD. This smart advisor would not let me do any of the ideas that I had. For every idea that I had, he kept saying, you know, this is incremental. It's not new. You have to think about something that no one's ever done before. That's really going to change, you know, the way that people think. That went on for almost a whole year. And so you can imagine a whole year of basically not doing any new studies, any new experiments. I kind of wrote up some of the stuff that I had from before. But, you know, on top of that, I was, you know, came to a new city where I really didn't know a lot of people. So I was kind of isolated in that respect. And the work wasn't going well and I couldn't do anything. And he kept telling me how it's not good enough. And he was right. It wasn't good enough. That was a lot of stress. And so at that point, I thought, well, okay, this, I had enough. I can't carry on. I better do anything else but science because I can't do this anymore. But my advisor back at NYU, where I did my PhD, said, you know, come back to me. We'll do something and then you'll find, you know, your next step from there. And so she told me that. I met her in New York. She told me that. I went back to Boston, told my advisor that I was about to leave. But there's still 4 weeks before I was to leave from Boston to New York. But those 4 weeks, I now was so relaxed because I knew I'm about to leave this situation about after 10 months of not doing anything. And so now I had 4 weeks to just sit around the office and read and think. And it was in those 4 weeks that I finally got the idea of the study that then turned up to be the optimism bias study, which I did later when I came back to New York. If he had let me to do any of the more incremental ideas that I had during those 10 months, I would not have been in the situation where I finally had a new idea, exactly the type of idea that he was pushing me to have. All the success that came after that was due to that one idea and that one paper that then led to everything that came after it. But also I learned my lesson, because that lesson that he taught me was something that I carried on. You know, from that point on, it was always in my mind. It has to be different. It has to be something that, you know, is really worthwhile, that's going to make a big change and be very novel.
And even though it was super stressful, I'm sure, to get that sort of feedback from your advisor, it ended up being a blessing in disguise, and you derived a valuable lesson from it. And I also can't help but see the similarities too between your own personal state. So going from very stressed to relaxed then allowed you to enter this like creative period in your life and come up with the idea that turned into later the optimism bias. And what we were talking about earlier, which is the impact of the environment on your ability to remain optimistic. You know, if you're stressed, then the optimism bias goes away. And if you're relaxed, it comes back. Let's transition to The Influential Mind, which, as I mentioned to you before we started recording here, it's one of my favorite reads in recent memory, and it tackles the neuroscience behind influence. One of the things I love about the book is how practical it is. You really get a lot of great strategies in there about influence, and particularly, and this is what I want to talk about now, is why facts don't change minds. So why is that the case? And I'm sure there are exceptions to this when data is actually valuable in influencing somebody else, but in general, facts and data don't seem to move the needle when it comes to influence. Why is that?
I think, again, we have to just put it in the right perspective, which is it's not that we don't form our beliefs according to facts and data, but it is in those situations where people already have a specific strong belief that facts and data and figures are not as effective in changing those beliefs. So if you're trying to change someone's mind, it is in those cases where facts don't really help as much. One reason for this is that we evaluate new evidence in light of the knowledge that we already have. If I already have a strong opinion about, let's say, gun control, and you give me a piece of evidence that goes counter to my opinion, I'm going to evaluate it in relation to the knowledge that I already have. And so that makes it quite difficult. The reason that the brain is actually built this way is because, on average, that is, in fact, the right way to form beliefs. The right way to form beliefs is to evaluate evidence in light of the beliefs that you already have. So let me give you an example. Let's say I told you that I saw a pink elephant flying in the sky. You would assume that I'm delusional or lying, as you should, because you have a very strong belief based on many years that elephants don't fly in the sky. And normally this is a right approach. We will be in real trouble if we just walked around, you know, the world, and every time that a little piece of evidence didn't fit our beliefs or someone had an opinion counter to our belief, we would change our beliefs and opinion. That would just, you know, cause chaos, and that's not the right thing to do. So on average, it's a good thing to do, and it's, you know, and that's the way we live, and it's exactly how we should. However, it also means that if we happen to have beliefs, very strong beliefs that are false, they are very difficult to change. There is one exception, though, and that is when the evidence doesn't conform to what you believe, but it conforms to what you want to believe. And that goes back a little bit to what we talked about, the optimism bias. So in cases where a piece of evidence is exactly what you want to hear, although you don't really believe it, then you're trying to change your mind. There's a great example of this by a group in the UK who actually studied Americans just before the presidential election. So in August 2016, they asked 1,000 Americans, hey, who do you want to win the election? And so about half said Trump and about half said Clinton. And then they asked them, okay, so who do you think is going to win the election? So back in August 2016, both the Trump supporters and the Clinton supporters believed that it was Clinton who was going to win. And then they showed them a poll, and the poll suggested a Trump victory. And they asked them again, okay, so after seeing this poll, have you changed your mind? You know, did your confidence change? And what they found was that the Trump supporters, although they didn't, you know, the Trump supporters didn't think that Trump was going to win before they saw the poll, after seeing the poll, they said, oh, in that case, maybe Trump will win. But the Clinton supporters, they didn't change their views much. They said, well, we don't believe this poll. You know, we still think she's going to win. So what matters is, does the evidence support what I already believe? Does it support what I want to believe? But there are other things that are, you know, that are helpful in changing people's mind. And turns out that one thing that is very strong is telling a story. Telling a story is more powerful in changing people's beliefs than, let's say, data or figures and graphs. And that makes sense because we kind of evolved, you know, it's kind of like big data and the mathematical, statistical, and analytical tools that we have. That's a very recent development. I mean, we have evolved for many, 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 many years, learning from the people around us, learning from stories of, you know, this person did this, and that's what happened to them. And that's how we learn. And it makes, you know, it makes sense that we learn like that. And we still do. And so when we hear a single story, that many times has more impact on us than lots of points of data put together. And another reason why stories are so influential is because they trigger emotion. So anytime that is something that is emotional, we tend to pay attention to it. We tend to remember it better. And that also causes us to change our minds more often than data that is not really triggering emotion.
Just to ground this a little bit more, one of my favorite examples from your book about this, the power of the story, is the supposed link between the MMR vaccine and autism. So all of the informational campaigns, you cite a study in the book showing that the informational campaigns actually don't work. In some cases, they backfire. They solidify people's beliefs that there is a link between the MMR vaccine and autism. And I'm sure it's in part due to the power of the story, right? I mean, they remember what so-and-so told them about how their kid got autism after they got a vaccination. And so all of the data and all of the facts in the world can't override the power of the story.
Right. So I start the book with this story of me watching the Republican presidential debate. And this was the first debate. And it was the two major candidates at the time were Donald Trump and Dr. Ben Carson. And they were talking about taxes and immigration and so on. And then the moderator turned to Ben Carson and he said, Trump has many times said that there is a link between autism and vaccines. You're a pediatric surgeon. What do you have to say? And so Ben Carson said, well, there's a lot of data and a lot of studies showing that there isn't a link. And he turned to Trump and he said, he's an intelligent person. Once he sees these studies, he will change his mind. And so the moderator then turned to Trump to see if he changed his mind. And Trump told a story. He told the story of an employee that he had who had a small baby, and the baby was taken to get its vaccines. And the vaccine was given in a horse-sized syringe. And later the baby got very ill and eventually had autism. And I was watching this with my 8-week-old son beside me. And I was quite amazed by my reaction because I had a very strong reaction to Trump's story. And I was surprised with this because, you know, I'm a neuroscientist. I'm trained to kind of make decisions based on the science. I know the science related to the link, the, you know, alleged link between autism and vaccines. And yet I had no reaction to Ben Carson's little speech, but I did have a reaction to Trump's speech. And I thought, well, you know, maybe I should think about this again. Maybe I shouldn't vaccinate my son. And it was quite concerning because if that was my reaction, you could imagine what would be the reaction of the millions and millions of others watching this who don't have, you know, scientific training, for example, or don't have prior knowledge about this. I mean, at the end of the day, I did vaccinate my son as I did my daughter before him. But it is a really good example of how an anecdote, especially one that is so vivid in details and rich in emotion, can have a very strong impact, much stronger reciting studies, for example.
Absolutely. And since we're on the topic of presidential elections and changing minds, suppose you're hired as an advisor to the Democratic Party, and they ask you, how do we convince a Trump supporter to vote for a different candidate in the 2020 presidential election? What would you tell them? How would you think through that question?
Right. Well, I mean, first of all, my opinion on this, based, you know, on some of the science, is that fear is not the answer. So I don't actually believe that fear campaigns are the ones that get people to act. And in fact, I believe that it is the campaigns that suggest change and hope that cause people to get out of their homes and go vote and act. A lot of times people say, well, but Trump's campaign is all about fear. But I don't think that is in fact correct because, you know, his slogan was Make America Great Again. I think what it did, it touched people's need for a change and their need to believe that things will be better, that things will be, you know, great again. I don't think it was the fear, but rather this kind of idea that we can change. So it's both the idea of, again, optimism, right? We'll change for the better. And also the idea that they can change, i.e. they can control something. People have a great need for agency. They have a great need for control. In fact, the one thing that our brain is trying to do at all times, it's controlling the environment in order to get reward and avoid harm. And so anytime that we feel we don't have control, we are quite anxious, we are unhappy. When we think we do have control, when we have a choice, when we have a voice, that's when people's well-being is enhanced. And so any kind of message that suggests taking back control, having control, making a change, committing an action is one that is very powerful. And the second message is a message of making things better, hopeful optimism. I mean, and this is not new. There's studies showing that people can predict who is going to win based on the number of like optimistic words used in speeches. I tend to think that it's more about what could be done to make things better and not so much if he wins, then these bad things happen. I would suggest not concentrating on all the negatives that can happen if the other side wins, but more on the positives that will happen if their side wins.
That makes sense. And that's consistent with another main takeaway that I had from your book, which was that hope or the reward approach works well when you're trying to inspire action. But fear is better if you're trying to get people to stop acting. It's like, you know, deer in the headlights. You freeze when you're afraid. And so if you're trying to get people to go to the ballots and vote for your preferred presidential candidate, then it makes much more sense to rely on positive messages of hope as opposed to negative messages of fear.
Yeah, so this is related to quite an interesting phenomena, both psychological and neuroscientific, which is sometimes called the avoid approach principle. And this is the idea that often to get the good stuff in life, whether it's, you know, getting food, chocolate cake, or finding love, or getting a promotion, we often have to do something, right? We often have to act to get rewards. So our brain has evolved in this kind of environment where you actually need to act to get a reward. And so anytime that we expect a reward, there's a go signal deep in our brain, in a part of the brain called the midbrain, and it goes through our reward system to our frontal cortex and up to our motor cortex, and it makes action more likely. And on the other hand, to avoid the bad stuff in life, whether it's poison or deep waters or untrustworthy people, often, not always, but often what we need to do is in fact not do anything. We need not to act. And so our brain has evolved in that kind of environment. And when we expect something bad, there's a no-go signal that starts deep in our midbrain, goes up to our motor cortex, and it inhibits action. It makes it less likely for us to act. Now, of course, we can overcome that. We can always overcome our first instinct, but that is the mechanism. And in fact, we've shown in a study that when you tell people you have to press a button to get a dollar, they press the button really fast. And when you tell them you have to press a button to avoid losing a dollar, so it's basically, you know, avoid a punishment, you're inducing a bit of fear, they press the button slower, right? Because they're in this kind of fear domain. And they're also sometimes make mistakes in which button to press. And they don't make as many mistakes when they press for reward. The idea is that if you want people to do something, to go out to vote, if you want, you know, your kids to tidy up the room or your employee to do a great job, anticipation of reward can work quite well. On the other hand, if you want people not to act, if you want your employee not to share information, or you want your kid not to eat the cookie, then in that case, perhaps fear can actually be the best solution. We have to remember also that if we are using this tactic of punishment and fear, it will have a negative influence on people's well-being. So that's another thing to keep in mind.
Well, Tali, unfortunately, we've come to the end of our time here. Thank you so much for a fascinating conversation. I encourage everyone listening to check out Tali's book, The Influential Mind. It's available wherever books are sold, and we'll include links to check out the book in the show notes. Tali, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for listening. Two things before you take off. First, if you don't want to miss out on future episodes of Famous Failures, please subscribe to the podcast on whatever platform you're listening on, and be sure to leave a review on iTunes or Google Play. Second, if you'd like to join thousands of others who receive a short email from me each Thursday with a list of articles, books, tools, quotes, and other gems that help you discover how extraordinary thinking produces extraordinary results, you can text my first name, which is Ozan, that's spelled O-Z-A-N, to 345-345. So once again, that's my first name, Ozan, O-Z-A-N, to 345-345. Or if you're in front of your computer, you can head over to ozanvarol.com and drop your email address. If you act now, you'll also get a free ebook called The Contrarian Handbook, 8 Principles to Innovate Your Thinking. As always, thank you for listening, and see you next time.